everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Leadership Focus, an internet radio show geared to everyday leadership, both at work and throughout your life. Each week, we present you with new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader with a more balanced life. I'm your host, Lisa Pasbjorg, Executive Coach and CEO of Focus Coaching, a leadership coaching and training firm based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Tonight, our speaker is Dr. David Cantor. And our topic is rethinking success, failure, and direction in a curious world. We're really in for a treat tonight. We're privileged to have David Cantor, surgeon, pharmaceutical industry veteran and visionary, an exceptional leader here to join us. Most well known for his 24-year career in the pharmaceutical industry, which ended as senior vice president to Pfizer Global Research and Development, and director of the Michigan Laboratories in Ann Arbor and Kalamazoo, David has had a rich and varied background. Most recently, he's been named to lead the University of Michigan's North Campus Research Complex, a space that comprises four land parcels, taking over 174 acres with 420,000 square feet of office space and a capacity for over 3,000 people to work there. Let's hear more about his journey to get there, his wisdom learned along the way, and the vision he has for his latest challenge. Welcome, David.
Good evening, Lisa.
It's great to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be a part of this show.
Yes, thanks for coming. Well, first, let's talk a little bit about your journey to get to your last role at Pfizer. Can you fill us in a little on your path and why you think you ended up there?
I can go a long way back. I arrived in the United States back in 1986. I had worked for the National Health Service as a surgeon for about 5 years and then joined the pharmaceutical industry, working in Northern Europe doing clinical trials. And on a visit to Ann Arbor, my boss at that time just turned to me and just said, "We'd like to work here." And I asked him if he was serious. He said, "No, I'm absolutely serious. I'll give you a job." And I was working on a project that was going to be a project that was scaled up. And I took the job. I came with my two-year visa, and it was 11 years before I left the United States for the first time. So I'm the story of the immigrant to some extent.
Yes. Well, a lot of people come to Ann Arbor and like it.
That's very true. Very true.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot to about spontaneous decisions that worked out very well. It's happened to me several times in my life where I've not thought too long and hard about a decision that had a major career impact, but it just seemed like a really fun idea at the time.
So where'd the shift come from, obviously being a physician, a surgeon, and into pharmaceuticals then?
That happened when, at the end of my residency, I had a real interest in moving into pediatric surgery. And back in the early 80s, the career structure of the National Health Service was really not that good. And a more senior surgeon took me aside and gave me the best career advice that I've ever had, I think, and really laid out the facts of how many places were going to be available in the next 5 to 10 years, that they had over-promoted some senior residents, and they were going to withhold appointing new ones for several years. And basically, it was sort of a hopeless task. And although the advice was at the time seemingly very negative, in the end, it was wonderful advice, because he could easily have chosen not to tell me any of that, and I would have just kept going for several years, not knowing the proposition. But I think it opened doors, and at that point, I was unemployed for quite a few months, and it made me think about other opportunities. And then I ended up meeting somebody who was working extensively in the pharmaceutical industry, and I just thought, you know, that sounds really interesting. And I ended up being hired by Park Davis at that point, and I got hooked.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fascinating field. So we have listeners all over the world, as I think you know. Can you briefly tell those who are not local about the closure of the Ann Arbor Research, Pfizer Research Facility, what that meant to the community? And I think maybe more importantly, what did it mean to you?
Right. The Ann Arbor facility was moved back in 1960 when Parke Davis had a research site down in Detroit. They moved it out to be very close to the university. And over time, it had grown to be a pretty large site. So when I arrived and was appointed head of the site in 2000, we had about 3,600 people working at the site, a mixture of employees and contractors. And the site had been very successful. So it was the site where Lipitor atorvastatin was both discovered and developed. Another drug that's been very successful, Lyrica, was discovered and developed there. Those are both drugs that have sold multi-billion dollars per year. And Pfizer acquired Park Davis Warner Lambert in 2000, and the site continued to have tremendous investment. And as a result of a series of mergers, it became obvious that Pfizer had more R&D facilities than it could afford. And while I did not expect the site to be closed, in 2007, early in 2007, that decision was made. So this is a site that was not the major employer. The University of Michigan is the major employer in Ann Arbor. It's a college town that's about 50 miles west of Detroit. The university is the major employer, but Pfizer at that point was the largest private employer and was the single largest taxpayer in the town, contributing maybe about 5% of all the taxes that ran the city. And it was a major influence,
that's,
I think,
huge.
In
yeah.
huge. In fact, it was five times the number two taxpayer was one-fifth of what Pfizer paid. So
wow.
There was a heavy dependency in not only taxes, but the arts. They were a good-paying employer. They had been there many years, and there was this feeling of it being a very successful enterprise. So in January of 2007, January 4th, I'd actually arranged a phone call with my boss. I thought I was going to discuss some goals and some progress of last year's goals and then look at the next year's goals. And it was a very short phone call, and he just said, "I don't really know how to tell you this in any other way than be straight out, and we've made a decision, and we're closing the site." And it was as short and as simple as that. And we spoke for a few minutes afterwards, but I think I was in shell shock because I did not see it coming.
Yeah. You know, my story with that, it's almost like, you know, where were you on September 11th, or where were you when Kennedy died? I had a physician who worked for me, a lovely young woman, part-time. And she knocked on my door, which was open, but she was being polite, and came in and she said, "Can I talk to you?" And I said, "Sure." And she looked really agitated. And she shut my door, and she leaned against the wall, and I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "I guess." And I said, "Well, what's going on?" And she said, "Pfizer's closing." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Pfizer's closing. You can't know this. It's not going to hit the press until..." And her husband worked there. And she was saying to me, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know whether I need more hours from you. I don't know whether we're moving." You know? And it was, you know, her life was in this whirlwind. And I was just stunned. I can only imagine how you felt.
Well, the period from January 4th through January 23rd was unreal to some extent. So when I was told, I could tell nobody whatsoever. And well, I broke that rule about 20 minutes later because I realized that the one person I could not fool was my admin, Sheila, and that there was no way that I was going to be able to hide. So, and that's a remarkable story because I had forgotten that her husband worked for the company too. And to her incredible credit, she didn't tell him until the night before the actual announcement was made. So I think that was quite remarkable and a great test of her.
Yeah.
What a huge test of her personal integrity.
Yeah.
But I think the old adage of a problem shared is a problem halved is very, very true. At least being able to talk to her briefly, you know, and think about what I was going to do. And then over about a week later, I was able to announce and tell all my leadership team, which was an extremely hard meeting. Though I think they had begun to sense that things were not well and were not right, because I actually went, I flew a few days later, I flew to New York to talk to the CEO. I think that's part of a leadership reaction that often happens, that you feel you can undo things. And I think in hindsight, it was a necessary part of my coming to terms with it. But I also think that it was probably unreal to expect a reversal of a decision.
What a process.
So, It was a process, and I think that I look back and I pretty much went through every emotion. And I think that, you know, in terms of any other leader being in that position or any other individual, I think it's perfectly okay to be both angry for a while and to be bitter and to replay what-ifs. Well, what if I had seen this coming? What would I have done differently? I think those are all very normal emotions. And then it really lasted probably longer than it should have been for me. But it was, you know, I was obviously working with people to both inform the rest of the site and then start various plans. But I think I do remember a very definitive moment when I went for a walk and I'd been chewing this over and I just suddenly decided I had to stop looking backwards and I simply had to reverse and absolutely spend as much time as I could looking forward and not worrying about whether I understood the decision, whether I could explain it to anyone else, whether I could have an opinion about it. I actually almost felt it was not important that I understood it, but it was more important that I really focus on moving ahead from a personal point of view.
Taking
but I
action.
Also think that shows as a leader.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say, everyone that I've spoken to that talks about that experience, many, many people in the company, relatives of people in the company, people in the community, still talk about how well you handled that. So even though obviously, you know, you were reeling and obviously you're human and all of that, it came across, they really respect the way that happened. That you delivered what was a very, very difficult message and communicated with people and, you know, did what had to happen.
Well, thank you for the comments. And I learned a lot along the way. And I do remember there was one very important moment. We were meeting just two or three days before the announcement was being made. All the leadership were in the meeting. And some people from New York had flown out, and they had this huge package presentation, and they started to present it. And I sensed in the room this sort of almost resentment and disbelief. And we just stopped, and I just said, all right, what do people think of this? And someone just said, you know, I don't think we should present a single one of this. This meeting is about 90 seconds long. Let's just cut to the chase and tell people the truth straight off, no preamble. And then we can do this the following day or when people might be a little bit more mentally prepared. And that is the decision we made. And all of this beautiful package has been prepared. We didn't use a single bit of it. And each of the leaders stood up with their group and just basically said, I've got some really bad news to part, and then just said it straight out. And that was done. And then we stayed. We let you know, let people talk a little bit, let people go home, phone their family, phone their, you know, their spouse and others. And I think that was a very important part of being honest. Honesty is not often long-winded. Honesty is often very brief and direct.
Yes, and it's often important to know when to stop talking.
Yes, yes. And in the session where we had all the discovery people, and someone came to the microphone and just said, well, so I understand discovery is being closed. So he, in his head, had a preconceived idea of what he was going to listen to. He didn't actually hear what was said, and it took several repetitions before you could see that look on his eyes change as he realized the whole site was closing. So again, it's an example that people don't hear first time. And
well, I'm visualizing somebody sitting in the doctor's office hearing that cancer word, you know,
right,
and then they hear that word and nothing else sinks in after that.
Or they don't
even
hear
that word.
They
don't have another person. They hear
something else that was said. You know, maybe the doctor was being reassuring at the end. He said, you know, I think you'll be all right. And they leave and they say, oh, that's good. That was good news in the end. So the doctor says, I'm okay. I'm going to be all right.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
It's an emotional reaction. People don't respond to what's necessarily said. There's all that flooding with the emotion. Yeah.
But a lot of good things, you know, for me personally have come since that time.
Yeah. And I want to switch a little bit into talking about kind of moving forward a little bit. And I have some questions related to that, I think, at least in part. One of my questions is, I know from my background running a nonprofit that was a medical relief organization and having really senior-level pharmaceutical executives on the board that the pharmaceutical industry is a really tough business. And I don't think most people realize when they complain about high pharmaceutical costs how much R&D that they're paying for, and not just on that drug, but on all the ones that failed. And what's the percentage of failure? Is there some kind of number of what the average percentage of drugs that fail that go through the process?
There are some published numbers, and I think they're optimistic. There's numbers saying that, you know, once you enter the clinic, about only 1 in 10 of those drugs will make it to the marketplace. I'd be delighted with 1 in 10. Actually, that would be outstanding success. I think my experiences were much more in the 1 in 25. So 4% success rate.
That's tiny.
Of course,
R&D is hugely expensive.
And a lot of that failure, you want to come fast and quick. So although it can be painful, if you can do a clinical experiment very early on that's a decisive experiment and you do it really well and you look at the result and you go, this is not going to be good enough, or this is, you know, this drug has to be taken 4 times a day and in this environment, you know, we need it to be a maximum of 2x a day or something, then you can make a decision. And that actually is what you really have to applaud people and make people feel very good about the ability to do really good experiments that allow decisions to be made.
Yes.
Because failure, the worst thing is the indecisive trial where you then look at it and go, well, were we just unlucky? Did we not design it right? Do we need to do it again and spend, you know, either several $100,000, several $1 million doing a repeat experiment. So if you can be decisive and do it well, that is really good science.
So design is so important. Really good design.
Good design, get your numbers right, get your doses right, ask the questions carefully, don't try to ask too many questions in one study. Collect the right information, get the right patients, and make sure they have if it's a disease or a syndrome or something that you're that you're trying to study, make sure that these patients truly have it. And of course, yeah. as we move into the genomic world, where disease, instead of being somewhat crudely defined, might be more precisely defined, this is the way with personalized medicine that we're viewing it is coming. So a cancer will no longer be just a cancer in a particular organ, a lung or a colon or skin. It will be a cancer that is actually driven by a particular cellular mechanism that's gone wrong. And that's the defining description, because then that defines what possible treatments are available.
That's fascinating stuff. And a whole other interview.
A whole other interview, very much so,
sometime
yeah.
in the future. So, David, in an industry that's so full of failed projects, how do you create a culture of optimism?
It's a great question. And I think that one of the secrets is that an organization has to taste success. Even if it's minor success, they have to know what it feels like. And in doing that, they can at least yearn to reproduce that feeling. An old boss of mine, President Ronnie Cresswell, who worked here in Ann Arbor, he was very, very much a huge advocate of this idea that an organization must taste success. And I think that praising people for what they've done, it doesn't always have to lead to a marketable drug, because we know that the vast majority of work that we do ends up either defining failure or is just work that's part of building a program. But you need to celebrate it, and you have to celebrate the belief that an organization has in itself. So we used to have scientific awards, we used to have awards around leadership, we used to make people feel very good that what they were doing was very worthwhile, and that in some way a patient who needed what they were researching was waiting for some outcome. This description, the patient is waiting, I think it came actually from another company, Lilly, in Indianapolis, that used this description, but it sort of went around many different R&D organizations, because in one phrase it seemed to capture why you would dedicate your life to new drugs. The patient is waiting.
Oh, yeah. What I'm doing every day, even though it doesn't always seem that exciting, is meaningful, is really meaningful down the road. That's so important to people.
Right. I mean, I was involved in Lipitor. It was a very successful drug. And at one point, I started sketching out, on the back of an envelope, how many people might have taken that drug. And it was somewhere around, 40 million people. And then I realized that in a lifetime as a physician, you may be able to treat 100,000 people. And it sort of it put me it into perspective that in an industry in new drugs, your ability to touch many, many more people than the one-to-one relationship that the doctors have with patients, it really makes a difference. And that 40 million is way higher than that now.
Yeah, that's a big impact. That's a really big impact. And important to keep in mind, and it sounds like something that you regularly were sharing with those you were leading to help them keep that in mind, that connection.
Very much so. I didn't use rah-rah sessions, standing out in front of everybody. I think it was very much, I used to write little handwritten notes. I still believe that in all the communication era, the handwritten note is probably the most powerful tool for saying well done or thank you. I found people stuck them to the back of their office, the cubicles and things, and I had these cards printed out with, a little logo on, and people would keep them, and I would just note that they had won an award, that they'd done a good study, or even had the birth of a kid. I used to write, and to every employee who ever had a child, I sent a plant and little handwritten note. Those things actually, I thought, connected me with people there.
It does, they're important, they're valuable, they're individuals, they're not just cogs. And everybody that has a child, you know, it's a miracle every time, especially to them. It's just amazing.
Well, it's great, a great feeling. It keeps an organization young.
It does. It does. And not everybody does it. You know, they don't take the time to do that. Well, I'm looking at our time, and we don't have lots of time left. This has gone really quickly. Let's see what I want to narrow this down to. Tell me about your position now and how you're using the skills and experience that you have up to now in this role.
I'm the leader and the executive director at this North Campus Research Complex. It's sort of somewhat ironic because it is the old Pfizer facility, although I'm trying to get everybody not to say the old Pfizer facility, but that's what it is. And the job I'm having is I have a small group of people, and our job is to create the environment to where researchers will move there. They will collaborate together. We're dealing with practical problems of getting the buildings up and running. We're dealing with problems with the faculty working out their finances, the business plan for their research ideas. We're dealing with a lot of expectations from the university. So I think the experience I've had from a corporate world is I do have a sense of urgency, which is great in a university environment, because it's not as used to that sense of urgency. I also
great and refreshing.
I believe strongly in accountability. I like single points of accountability for projects. When I came in 4 months ago, I first question I asked was, well, whose project is this? And no one put their hand up. No one, and other people then slowly said, well, I'm responsible for this bit. And it was so a committee was running, and I just said, fine, that's going to stop. We're going to have one person who will be accountable for delivering this project to a happy customer. And let's talk about customers. Who are they? It was a very refreshing conversation. I think people actually like that type of responsibility. And I think people rise to it. So those are the skills that I think I brought from a corporate type of private company background that in a university setting are different. I built many teams.
Yes.
I enjoy building good teams.
Yes.
Now,
how
before...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, in between leaving Pfizer and then starting in this job, I had about a year and a half in an academic setting at an institute that's part of the business school. That was very good for me. It taught me a lot about the university world, how frustrating it is, how entrepreneurial faculty have to be to go and get grants. And I wrote a paper and submitted it, and after a year it got rejected. So I feel like I was a true academic in some ways. At least I had the rejection of both grants and a paper. I have other papers published, but that was a good 18-month period.
Sure. So what is it that you intend to accomplish in the next couple of years with your team?
So I want to grow the site to its full potential, you know, 3,500 people working there. But I want to grow it in a way that has this real interesting mix of faculty researchers, private enterprise, private companies coming in and working with us in collaborative ventures, and an entrepreneurial culture where the startups are being spun out and being nurtured through their first couple of years before they may move to another location. But something that makes the University of Michigan a much broader umbrella for people to come work at, and to very attractive to researchers, because the entrepreneurial researcher is definitely and the entrepreneurial faculty member is a real phenomena, and these are people who want to come to a university where they're allowed to do this type of activity as well as really good science. So I think that's what I'd like to achieve, other people being very successful.
Great. So we're actually out of time. How can people find out more about this North Campus Research Facility?
Well, probably the easiest thing is just to Google North Campus Research Complex and University of Michigan, and that'll take them to press some press briefings and publications that have come out, and our website should be easy to find.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, David.
Lisa, thank you so much. I've enjoyed the discussion.
Great. Thank you for joining us tonight on the Leadership Focus, the show which gives you new ideas, interesting guests, actions, strategies, and be an incredible leader, more balanced life. Hope that you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please go to blogtalkradio.com and become a friend and make us a favorite. To sign up for our free newsletter with more tips and strategies you can use, go to focuscoaching.net on the web. That's focuscoaching.net. Until next time, this is your host, Lisa Pasbjorg, urging you to be a better leader every day.